Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jody Freeman, who is the Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of the law school's Environmental Law and Policy Program, the co-author of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She also served as counsel for energy and climate change in the Obama White House. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jody Freeman.
Great to be with you.
And yesterday, there were a number of, I think about 300-odd marches around the world, billed as People's Climate Marches. There were 200,000 people in Washington, D.C. in the sweltering heat. They marched down Pennsylvania Avenue and surrounded the White House and let out a collective moan as though coming from the very, you know, agony of Gaia herself. What was your sense of this extraordinary contrast between yet another manifestation of spontaneous resistance on the part of American citizens, at the same time a president in the hermetic bubble of his own base talking about beautiful clean coal and threatening to pull out of the Paris Climate Accords?
I think it is a pretty jarring contrast. I think, you know, everything the president says about coal and fossil fuels, it all seems very much about yesterday. He doesn't seem to understand that a clean energy transition is already underway, and it's not mostly because of regulation or government. It's mostly because of the market and mostly because there is a lot of innovation going on in the clean energy space. So I think yesterday people were making their views known that they care about climate change as an issue, and I think more generally they care about environmental protection, and they see what he's doing, you know, to roll back these protections that have put in place now for many generations. So I think they're expressing their wish to have clean air, clean water, and to have a government that's serious about the transition to clean energy.
But just before the People's Climate Marches on Saturday, Donald Trump opened up offshore, previously banned offshore drilling in sensitive areas like the Arctic and off the California and Atlantic coasts. So could there be another explanation here? Given the influence that the Koch brothers have over the Trump administration, in particular, Mike Pence, who's one of their protégés, along with the new head of the EPA, who's also another one of their protégés, and having Rex Tillerson, the former head of Exxon, as a Secretary of State. Is it possible that the dirty fuel extractive economy is trying to have its last hurrah, one last gasp of a dying industry?
You know, I don't know about the background dynamics that are going on, and I don't really get into sort of conspiracy theories. But what I can tell you, Ian, is this yesterday's behavior by the president and his ongoing rhetoric, it's all of a piece. You know, it's a lot of signaling and gesturing to a core constituency of his in the coal sector. And he's really making a bunch of empty promises about bringing jobs back, and they're not coming back. And the reason is because the market has moved away from coal. It happens to be, although for many years it was crucial and remains important in our energy economy, it happens to be an incredibly dirty and dangerous fuel. And sometimes the public makes known that it cares about public health, and so we are moving toward cleaner sources of energy, and that's a good thing for society, and it happens to be falling heavily on parts of the country with coal jobs. Those coal jobs have been disappearing for a long time. They're not the product of anything the Obama administration did. And what he really should be doing is announcing plans to help revitalize and diversify the economies in these areas and help people out in transitioning to new kinds of training and new kinds of jobs. We need an education plan. We need a lot of things, but what he's been promising and opening up offshore drilling and reversing the pause on new coal leasing in order to open up more public lands to coal mine, all of this is a bunch of empty rhetoric. Nobody's interested in drilling right now in these offshore areas. The price of oil is too low. There's not going to be a bunch of new leasing in these parts of the outer continental shelf. There's not going to be a bunch of bidding for new coal leases because coal's losing out to cheap natural gas as a source of electricity. So you see a lot of smoke and mirrors at the presidential level in the White House. You see a lot of executive orders and announcements of things. But it just is completely contrary to the dynamics and reality on the ground.
Well, I certainly was struck by the recent announcement that Tesla, Elon Musk's electric car company, has a greater market capitalization than General Motors. So that would support what you're saying. In other words, in the real world, the economic bets are being made on clean energy, not on dirty energy.
I think that's right, and I think that that valuation actually surprised even Elon Musk, who commented in the press that it's really quite astonishing. But it shows you what people think the future is about, and the future is about a transition to these sort of cleaner sources of energy. And I think that the Tesla story is a real story of innovation and really future-oriented thinking. You look at one of these vehicles, and they're very impressive. And I think young people out there, when they see this kind of innovation in the transport sector, and they see alternative clean energy sources for electricity, and they see things like solar panels and opportunities to invest in technology that will actually feed power back to the grid, I think generationally we're going to see an embrace of all of this innovation. And I think we're headed toward a much different energy future. And everything the president is doing is really just part of this retrenchment and clinging to an old past. So all the signals, and actually all the businesses understand these signals, all the signals are in the direction of moving out of coal and more toward natural gas, moving out of both coal and gas toward more solar and wind power, and in the transport sector, moving to hybrids and then all electric vehicles over time. I just think this is an unstoppable trajectory. Maybe possible to slow it down for a time with the president's retrograde policies, but I think the writing is on the wall, and sophisticated players in the business community really understand this.
And again, I'm speaking with Jody Freeman, the Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of Harvard Law School's Environmental Law and Policy Program, the co-author of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House. But nevertheless, even though the promises, of course, and in yesterday's speech in Pennsylvania, or rally in Pennsylvania, Donald Trump did talk about beautiful clean coal and how he loves the miners and how they're all going to go back to work, which, of course, flies in the face of a recent study by Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy that concluded that Donald Trump's effort to roll back environmental regulations will not materially improve economic conditions in America's coal communities. He still can do some real damage in terms of pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords, which he talked about in the rally, hinting very, very heavily that it was a one-sided accord where the United States pays billions of dollars while China, Russia, and India and have contributed and will contribute nothing, quoting him. And he said that it'll be decided in a couple of weeks, but I'm kind of leaning against it. So what do you think's going on there?
Well, once again, unfortunately, everything the president says about the Paris Agreement is just fundamentally misinformed. This agreement is actually the most balanced, most inclusive international agreement on climate change in the history of international negotiations on this subject. And what I mean by that is actually all of the world's major economies are pledged to this agreement. It's not just the developed world. It's certainly not just the United States, but all of the world's developing major economies too. China and India have pledged as well significant reductions in their carbon intensity per unit of GDP over time. So everybody is in this, and it's actually very different than past agreements that bound just the developed economies. And the other thing to say about this idea that the U.S. is going to pay billions and billions and nobody else will, it totally misrepresents the situation. Part of the Paris Agreement is a commitment to a green climate fund, and this is really financing that will help the poorer nations transition during climate change and adapt and invest in resiliency, and that's good for all of us so that there won't be humanitarian and environmental crises that we have to intervene in. And the fund will also help them to mitigate and cut their emissions to address the problem. And it's really a about $10 billion fund, and the U.S. pledged $3 billion to it over 4 years. And we are not alone in this pledge. Over 40 countries pledged money to this fund, and major commitments from countries like Japan and Britain and France and Germany. So you just mischaracterize the situation in suggesting that the U.S. is overpaying. You know, we're one of the richest countries in the world. We benefited from industrialization. We've produced a rich country by producing an awful lot of greenhouse gases. And the poorer countries haven't yet had the benefit of development. And so it makes some sense to assist them in this transition. And I think the Obama administration's pledge of $3 billion was a very reasonable and modest down payment. And Obama actually managed to make good on about $1 billion of that pledge before leaving office.
So can it be undone? I mean, obviously there's been some buzz that the international leadership, like Merkel, I assume, and the British PM and others are trying to weigh in and discourage Trump from pulling the plug on the Paris Accords.
It's interesting because, you know, you can undermine the U.S.'s commitment to the Paris Accords just by doing the kinds of things the president has already announced that he wants to do, by unraveling the domestic policies that are key to fulfilling our pledge. So he's already announced that he wants the EPA to take another look and roll back potentially the Clean Power Plan, which is regulation of greenhouse gases from the electricity sector for the first time. He's already said he's interested and expects the EPA to take another look at the fuel efficiency standards that have doubled fuel efficiency standards out to the year 2025. If those policies are significantly weakened or unraveled, we won't be able to meet our short-term Paris pledge. So that's one way to undermine Paris. The other way is to actually do what it sounds like he says he's leaning toward doing, but we won't quite know until he tells us, and that is to officially begin the process of withdrawing from the Paris Agreement. And that's really just an unnecessary poke in the eye of all of the U.S. allies, and it's also going to set back a lot of U.S. business that thinks there are benefits to come from being part of the Paris Agreement and ongoing international negotiations. So to me, it's an unnecessary kind of gasp for attention. I think the international community, to be honest with you, Ian, has already internalized the very strong possibility that the U.S. is not going to deliver in the short term on its pledge. I think they've already figured out that this guy may well, just to get press attention and cater to a certain narrow constituency, may actually begin the withdrawal process. But the fact is that withdrawal process as a legal matter takes 4 years. And so it would only take effect into the next presidential administration. And, of course, depending on who the president is in 4 years, they may well reverse things and want to be a member again of the international community.
Well, do you think, for example, that his new best friend, Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, he might notice that they're switching as quickly as they can now, notwithstanding that they've done, I think, greater environmental damage, and now people can't even breathe in Shanghai and Beijing. So there is obviously a growing constituency in China to deal with the awful damage that has already been done to their environment. I don't know whether you noticed the big story in today's New York Times about how the Chinese international fishing fleet is basically killing off fish stocks around the world. So there are major problems that are being that aren't being dealt with. But it does seem that China is at least on the path of dealing with them. And if our leaders are trying to turn back from the path already that we've been on.
Yeah, look, there's no greater winner from Trump's antics than the Chinese. The idea that the U.S. would publicly say it's withdrawing from an international agreement it led just makes way for the Chinese to become the new leaders of international climate change. And the irony of this just should not be lost on the United States. Nobody will benefit more from developing their clean technology than China, from being a leader in solar power, from being a leader in battery research and storage. They're going to move right into the territory when we recede. And so this is just a fundamental and tragic mistake for American business and innovation and international leadership. There's no question the Chinese are dealing with this problem. I don't think they're primarily driven by climate change, though it is a concern because they will suffer from both drought and flooding and erratic weather events, there's no doubt. But I think they're primarily obviously driven by what you cited, Ian, which is local conventional air pollution problems that are killing hundreds of thousands of Chinese. And the growing middle class is realizing that they need to have and want to have a basic minimum standard of environmental health and protection, and that's what the Chinese are going to deliver. So they're on a path to slow their CO2 emissions and to reduce their other conventional pollution. They're going to invest heavily, as they already are, in renewable energy. And it's astonishing that with the Trump administration in power, we are laggards behind China in this domain. I think we just all shake our heads and think, what a lost opportunity for the United States.
Well, just in closing, though, Trump is doing real damage. The EPA budget, which he's cutting, eviscerating, almost putting them out of business. Their work on batteries, which apparently has been extremely helpful, has all but been erased as a budget item.
Well, so, the budget is stark and quite shocking. 31% cut for EPA's budget and 21% cut for its workforce. It's the hardest hit agency of all of the federal agencies in the Trump budget proposal. You cannot miss the message. The message is we wish to dismantle the enforcement power of this agency. Now, presidents very rarely get what they want in their budgets, right? It has to go through the Congress. But the signaling is very clear, and that is that this whole investment in public health protection and environmental protection is not a priority of this agency, this administration, and nor is it particularly a priority of Scott Pruitt, who now runs the EPA. And so I think the budget is signaling something that President Trump has been signaling since he took office, and that is that they're just prepared to roll everything back to the extent they can. Just before closing, I want to say that may be the aspiration. But there are a lot of steps to take to execute such a dramatic and drastic set of cutbacks. And you can bet that there are an army of states and non-governmental organizations that are interested in the public health and environmental groups and citizens that are prepared to litigate every effort to go beyond what the law allows the Trump administration to do in rolling these things back. So you're about to see trench warfare in the courts. To try to resist what people think is just a historic retrenchment. And I think we'll be seeing that unfold over the next few years.
Well, Jody Freeman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I'll be speaking with Jody Freeman, who's an Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of Harvard Law School's Environmental Law and Policy Program, the co-author of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the latest anemic quarterly GDP numbers of growth of 0.7%.